BBC.
BBC.
Hello and welcome to Politics UK. I'm Edward Sturton. That first Oval Office moment is likely to be given a prominent place among the framed photographs on the piano lid of any British Prime Minister. From the days when Churchill wooed Roosevelt to join Britain's war with Hitler, to the balmy romance of Thatcher and Reagan in the Cold War years, the so-called special relationship has loomed large in British politics. Sometimes British commentators write about it in the sort of detail that would bring a blush to the cheeks of a romantic novelist. When Tony Blair and George Bush met for the first time, there was much breathless speculation about the significance of the fact that they used the same brand of toothpaste. This week, David Cameron got his first Oval Office moment with Barack Obama.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Prime Minister Cameron on his first visit to the White House as Prime Minister. We have just concluded some excellent discussions, including whether the beers from our hometowns that we exchanged are best served warm or cold.
So let me thank you again, Barack, for hosting me today. While at the World Cup, our teams could only manage a score draw, I believe our relationship can be a win-win.
All very genial, even though there was the awkward issue of the freeing of the Lockerbie bomber to discuss. But what if the romance is somewhat one-sided, if it means rather more to us than it does to the Americans? Just before leaving, David Cameron said we shouldn't, as he put it, fret incessantly about the special relationship. I asked Sir David Manning, who was the British ambassador in Washington during the later Blair years, whether he agreed with Mr. Cameron's view.
Yes, I do think he's right about that. I think it's something we obsess about, and we shouldn't. We should be more relaxed about it. If you take this relationship, which sometimes feels as though if everything's going fine, everybody's accusing the government of the day of being poodles. And then if there's a problem, everybody goes to the other extreme and starts saying, oh my goodness me, this relationship we have with the United States is in tatters. One of the things about the special relationship is that I think Americans are a bit puzzled about the way that we do obsess about it. I think they feel it's strong. Of course they're in a different position, as successive prime ministers have always recognised. They are the only superpower. They have very close and special relations with all sorts of countries, actually. But we have a particular relationship that certainly goes back to the Second World War, through the Cold War. We have a similarity of view about many international issues. We have a very close economic and financial relationship. And there is the human relationship. All those things are there. And from time to time, personalities count a lot in terms of the visibility. But the fundamentals of the relationship are very strong.
Is it also fair to say that as the priorities of both the government here and the government in Washington turn away from the war on terror, with Iraq winding down, with the possibility of Afghanistan winding down too, we become slightly less important as a strategic partner as a result of that?
Well, I think that's true in the security field, though we've got a long way to go before these wars are actually behind us. But I think there are all sorts of other issues that we will be talking to one another about and contributing together. We want an open trading system. We are champions of this. And this is going to be vital to the global recovery. I think one of the interesting areas, and I don't know whether the Prime Minister has been talking about this to the President or not, is how do you move forward the global institutions. A lot of talk about the G20. As far as I can see so far, not much delivery. If we are going to tackle security issues, climate change, international trading system, and so on, there's going to have to be a more effective international mechanism and international machinery to do this.
You mentioned personalities. We've seen famous double acts, Reagan and Thatcher, Blair and Bush, and so forth. What do you make of the Cameron style as he approaches his relationship?
I like his style. He's got away, I think, from some of the emotional hype that sometimes surrounds the relationship. Well, he's tried to.
Had to deal with a couple of difficult issues. BP squared, if you like, both BP the polluter and BP the alleged pusher of the idea that the Lockerbie bomber should be freed. What do you make of the way he's handled those?
I don't know the ins and outs of the actual negotiations over Al-Megrahi and all these other things, but I assume that when the Prime Minister has said that, you know, this was a decision that was taken by the Scottish government, he regrets that. Fundamentally, it is about a political decision taken by a government. You may be lobbied by all sorts of people to do all sorts of things, though I haven't seen anything specifically that says that BP mentioned Megrahi's name. I'm not sure about that. But ultimately, the decision goes to the government, and they must make up their minds. And apparently the Scottish government decided to release him, and that's what happened.
But in terms of the way that he's played it, David Cameron's played it during his time in Washington, saying he's going to open up the papers, but declining the idea of a further full inquiry. From your time in Washington, do you think that's the sort of the way to handle something like this, and will actually quieten people down?
I don't know how far it will quieten people down, to be honest. Once an issue acquires this sort of saliency in Congress, it's very hard to predict what will happen next. Clearly, emotions are running high, and I simply don't know how far opening up the papers will assuage this concern on the Hill.
And in terms of the broader trajectory of the relationship, if you like, is it fair to say that this president is the first pacificist, if that's the right word, president in the sense that we've talked about Atlanticist presidents in the past?
Well, I don't think I'd quite characterise it like that. I think that Obama is the first post-Cold War president. He's not only a post-war president, he's a post-Cold War president, and he comes with a very different sort of upbringing and a very different experience. And so in the sense that, of course, he grew up in Hawaii part of the time and he spent time in Indonesia, his Pacific experience is clear. But I think it's more that he is unsentimental about international relations. I think that his perspective isn't one that was formed growing up during the pressures of the Cold War. And I think he has a different perspective generally. I wouldn't try and typecast him as a Pacific president. I think what we have to be aware of is that he is not the sort of Atlantic-focused president that we have been used to since the Second World War.
Sir David Manning. Speaking after his meeting with Barack Obama, David Cameron suggested that some British troops could be leaving Afghanistan as early as next year. Britain's involvement in Afghanistan has now lasted for nearly 9 years, and the past few weeks have seen an especially heavy toll of casualties. Everything now suggests that the government is laying the ground for a withdrawal from combat missions there. An international conference in Kabul this week agreed a timetable for Afghan forces to take over responsibility for security in Afghanistan from NATO. And in the House of Commons, the Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, standing in at Prime Minister's questions because of David Cameron's absence in Washington, was asked about the government's commitment to bring the troops home.
No timetable can be chiselled in stone, but we are absolutely determined, given how long we've been in Afghanistan, given that we are 6 months into an 18-month military strategy embarking on a new political strategy, that we must be out in a combat role by 2015.
This was Nick Clegg's first outing at PMQs, incidentally, and the first time, indeed, that a member of his party has ever faced this particular parliamentary ordeal since the tradition of Prime Minister's questions began in the 1960s. And a couple of his answers landed him in trouble. Shortly after giving the answer we've just heard, he had to correct himself.
First, lest there's any confusion on the vital issue of Afghanistan, which I hope will continue to enjoy cross-party support, let me be absolutely clear that we will see our troops withdrawn from Afghanistan from a combat role by 2015. That is what we are determined to see happen.
So 2015 is indeed, it seems, chiselled in stone. But was the incident symptomatic of a more general confusion about Britain's Afghan policy? Professor Malcolm Chalmers of the Royal United Services Institute has close ties with officials in Whitehall and has advised the Foreign Office on Afghanistan in the past.
I don't think the leaders of the British government have quite got their ducks in a row on this yet, and it was very significant, I think, that Nick Clegg had to be corrected, and indeed corrected his own statement in the House of Commons. But they do seem to be converging on an agreed position that British combat troops will be out of Afghanistan by 2015, no matter what. That seems to be now the official position. So it has, I think, become a deadline, while previously it was a target.
That raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it? The first one, I suppose, being how that goes down in Afghanistan, because presumably, if you're a member of the Taliban, the conclusion you draw from that is, well, we'll just hide in the hills and hang on.
Well, 5 years is a long time to hide in the hills. And the plan is that during that time, circumstances in Afghanistan will change, political circumstances, but also the capability of Afghan security forces, so that even if the Taliban is still seeking to fight by then, they will have Afghans to fight against, who will still be supported by NATO forces if necessary, but they won't actually be in the front line fighting.
You talked about two elements of the situation within Afghanistan, the political element and the security aspect. Let's talk about the first of those a little bit, because there have been all sorts of mutterings about the need to talk to the Taliban, about the need to create some kind of overarching political settlement. Do you see any significant movement really in that direction?
The most significant process of talking to the Taliban has to be done by Afghans, not by foreigners. What foreigners can do, however, is facilitate that process and make it clear whether or not they are happy with particular steps. I think it's very significant that Karzai is clearly developing a much closer relationship with the Pakistanis, and particularly the Pakistani military and intelligence agency. He's had them in Kabul several times. He sacked some of his cabinet members who were most antagonistic to Pakistan. He's clearly exploring the possibilities of, through the Pakistanis, with Pakistani help, doing some sort of negotiation, at least exploration of options with important elements of the Taliban. Now, the Americans clearly are rather sceptical of this, but I think even more important actually than the Americans is the other groups within Afghanistan. The Taliban are almost entirely a Pashtun group, but the old Northern Alliance, the Tajiks and Uzbeks, Hazaras, who suffered most under the Taliban, certainly don't want to return to Taliban control. And they have been so far the mainstay of the Karzai government. But also, most of the troops in the Afghan army are not Pashtun. They're Tajik, most of all. And therefore, there's a delicate issue of management of relations within Afghanistan.
But if you stand back from the complexities that you've just described, is it fair to say that if you look down the telescope at 2015, by that stage, if Afghanistan is going to be stable, you have to have some kind of political settlement that at some level does include the Taliban? They're not going to disappear before then.
No, the Taliban is an indigenous movement with significant popular support, particularly in the south of Afghanistan. And that support has been greatly increased by the corruption and venality of elements of the Afghan government. So it's not going to disappear. There will have to be some political settlement that gives some place to them. But the other element that should not be forgotten is that the Afghan Taliban has regained the power it now has because it's had a safe haven in Pakistan, supported by elements of the Pakistani security forces.
We hear ministers say, as if it's easy, one day the Afghan security forces will be able to take over from our forces. That's not really true, is it?
In any civil war, the military capability of the forces is only one element in the struggle. Much more important, actually, is gaining the support of local people. So they're more prepared to rely on one side or another, more prepared to risk sometimes their lives because they're getting other benefits to support one side or another. So there are lots of imponderables. It's not simply a case of whether or not Afghan forces can shoot straight.
But you wouldn't think that it's as complex as that to listen to some of our ministers occasionally. You'd think it really was a question of training them to shoot straight, wouldn't you, when they say the Afghan security forces will be trained so they can take over from us. As you say, it's much more than that.
It's much more complex. I think perhaps inevitably governments always struggle. We're seeing this government struggling over the last couple of weeks to develop a common narrative about what they're about in a very complex situation with lots of uncertainties. And what they tend to do, what all governments tend to do, is I think they tend to oversimplify and then everybody repeats the same message again and again. We saw this with the last government. We see it with this one. It doesn't mean that David Cameron or William Hague or Nick Clegg aren't fully aware of how complicated this issue is, but what would clearly be very damaging to them domestically would be if they all started talking about the complexities, and it would leave the public feeling even more confused than they are at present.
Professor Malcolm Chalmers, you're listening to Politics UK on the World Service of the BBC with me, Edward Sturton. The Immigration Minister, Damian Green, has said that it would be un-British to ban the burqa or the full veil worn by some Islamic women. He was speaking after the French Parliament passed a bill to introduce a burqa ban with a thumping majority. Only one MP voted against it. The French bill still has to be passed by the Senate, and it may be subject to a legal challenge on the grounds that it violates the Constitution. But Dominique Moisy of the French Institute for International Relations told me that the ban has widespread support in France.
The feeling of the French on the burqa, the full veil, is utterly negative. I mean, it seems a violation of all the values of Europe in general and of France in particular.
It's interesting that a minister in this country, since you raised the question of values, has said that he thinks a ban on wearing it would be un-British.
It is, I think, a very interesting distinction between France and Great Britain. And there are probably many explanations for the differences. But you must realize that in France, there is a religion which is rarely discussed, and that is the religion of secularism, which has in France a very particular word, laïcité. The French are at heart laïc, and they see the full veil as a violation of that religion of laïcité.
France also has a very strong tradition of liberty and is very proud of its place in framing the way we understand that word. Is there no concern about a ban on that score?
Well, there's the old saying of the French Revolution, there is no liberty for the enemies of liberty. There is a feeling that the full veil is in total contradiction with the liberty of women, though it may be disputable, but also the sociability. European civilization is based largely on the art of portrait and seeing the face of the other, exchanging with the eyes of the other, is perceived as the key to the Western civilization. And I think that's why you see such a unanimity, at least against the burqa, if not against the law itself and the principle of applying law to such an issue.
There are two legal questions at issue. One is whether the law is constitutional because of the question of liberty, and the other is whether it can be actually enforced.
Well, two questions are linked. What is a law that cannot be enforced? What does it mean if by law the veil, the full veil, is totally forbidden, and if a policeman in suburbs of Paris, where the rule of law barely exists, cannot apply such a law? Can you see policemen arresting in the streets women wearing the full veil? Will they force them to take that veil in public, so to speak, with the risk of creating uproars and acts of violence? But as far as the constitutionality of the law is concerned, I think the French in their majority are so much shocked by the message sent by the full veil, a message of total distance, total absence of confidence. I don't want to be you. By, in fact, what they can read as a message of provocation to the others, not so much as this is what I am and you have to respect what I am.
Dominique Moisy with the picture in France. A British Conservative MP, Philip Hollobone, has put down a private member's bill proposing a similar ban in Britain. It won't reach the statute book because it doesn't have government support. But Mr. Hollobone has also made headlines by declaring that he won't speak to veiled women in his constituency surgery.
Well, first of all, the problem has not arisen because I haven't had a veiled woman come to any of my surgeries. But I was asked the hypothetical question, what would happen if a veiled woman did come to one of my surgeries? And I said, well, I would ask her politely to remove her veil on the basis that if you want a face-to-face meeting with your MP, you can't have that if your face is covered. If she refused to remove the veil, I would then say to her, well, you need to contact me by some other means. Telephone call, letter, email, be very happy to take up your case, but I regard it as a discourtesy that I can't see your face. And the same rule for me would apply were a man to come into my surgery wearing a full face balaclava. I would regard that as rude, frankly.
I discussed the burqa with Yasmin Alibi Brown, a Muslim columnist and author, and with Sahida Salim, who hit the headlines in Britain when she refused to go through a full body scanner at Manchester Airport. Sahida Salim joined our discussion a little late, so I first asked Yasmin Alibi Brown what she would say to women who choose to wear a burqa.
I've never believed that choice in any part of our lives is the only imperative for what we do. Most of us would like to do many things which we don't, because we have to think about society, the impact, and so on. You know, it is to me no different from those 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds walking around with hardly anything on who are saying, it is our choice. We have to think beyond that choice argument.
Well, it's not quite the same as that, is it? Because very often it is mature women who decide to dress in this way. And they do so usually for reasons that they sound very convincing. They say, for example, that this is a religious choice that they're making, that they believe in the idea of modesty. It's not quite like wandering around with too few clothes on when you're a teenager.
I think that these two are completely connected. Both of them are to do with the sexualized identity of the woman. These things have meaning. It's not just a ring I'm wearing or a cross I'm wearing around my neck. What this says is, I accept, as a grown-up woman, or I insist that my daughter has to cover up because there's something inherently sexual about me as a female and destructive and attractive to men in a way that is not good for me or them. Well, I'm sorry. That is the exact other side of the coin of the over-sexualization of not wearing clothes. And I'm forever criticizing younger and younger girls and even grown-up women who dress in the way they do. When you sexualize yourself as a product or you cover yourself because you think you are a sexualized object, to me they're the same coin.
It's one thing to say that the burqa and associated forms of covering are bad things, that you don't approve of them. Different thing to say that we should ban it. Do you think we should in this country?
I think banning is such a hard weapon. A better way of doing it would be to say, in certain positions, in certain interactions, and absolutely in our schools, there's going to have to be a dress code. And it's a dress code that fits in with everybody's life. When we live in a complex society, if you just accommodate every demand, then you can't be a society. So we can reasonably say in school, girls will not be complete. They can wear trousers, they can wear full long-sleeved clothes. But no, a headscarf on a six-year-old is not acceptable. And showing a face in universities, in doctor's surgeries, talking to your MPs too, I think we can reasonably expect that.
I'm going to bring it in at this point, Shahida Salim, who is one of those women who says she has indeed chosen to be veiled. Shahida Salim, can you firstly just describe what you're wearing so our listeners have a sense of it?
Well, you're familiar with the word burqa. Well, burqa doesn't have to be one piece. Burqa can be a two-piece burqa as well, because nowadays it's been modified for convenience. So I've got a two-piece burqa, but the only difference is that my jilbab, the one I wear underneath, is like a coat. It's a long coat. Comes down to my ankles. It's loose fitted, and the scarf I wear on top is white, which I tie across my face, and just my eyes show.
And why do you feel you need to dress in that way?
I believe that my religion expects me to dress like this. The reason's basically to keep the society pure, basically the attraction between a man and a woman, because God has made that attraction there. And he had to have some control, because as we know, the thing that keeps a man and woman together, we have to procreate to increase the population. It's a very, very strong driving force. And if this is not controlled in some way by dressing modestly and to lowering the gaze and having some, like my burqa works like you can say, like a barrier. It protects me.
Let me bring in Yasmin Alibi Brown again at this point.
I think it's such an insult to Muslim men to say that they cannot look at a woman like I am, with my eyes, with my hair, and not go mad. And rape in Saudi Arabia and in Afghanistan is higher than it is in most European countries. So the idea that this is protecting women is simply not borne out.
And before I go back to Shahida Salim, also Yasmin Alibi Brown, what about the point that she makes that she believes that Islam requires that she dress in this way?
I checked this surah because I've read it too. There are five translations of these lines, five. One of them says, lower your veils. The other one says, lengthen your veils. One, the official version that is spread by some of the Muslim communities here, says cover yourself completely, including one eye, and look out with one eye, which just shows that the same surah has so many interpretations.
Shahida Salim, do you feel that you're put at a distance from the rest of society when you're dressed as you are?
The only distance that I'm put at is the distance that I require, that the Quran is telling me that I don't want to be annoyed. Basically, you have to understand why I'm wearing this. Now, I need a certain amount of separation, right? Total segregation I cannot have. This is what my hijab gives me. It segregates me, it separates me in a very the amount of segregation and separation I need, it gives me that. No man will really come up to me and address me and talk to me, okay?
That's just unnatural. I'm sorry. That's just unnatural. If you have sons, it's unnatural. Men and women have got to talk.
I talk to men. I've not had any problem and talking and with any person. Islam does not stop me from talking.
To make the relationship between men and women a purely sexual one is an insult to both men and women. And the fact that there are women in Afghanistan and in Saudi Arabia and in Iran who are being tortured because they're not covering themselves in the garment you say you feel good about wearing. I don't know how in any conscience you can do that.
All I know has been wearing it for 15 years old and I started wearing this in Pakistan. I've never had anybody, in fact I had to fight to wear this because people stared at me and I didn't like it. When I turned 15 and I was growing, people stared at me, okay? I'm not accusing men of being unchaste.
Shahida Salim, I tell you what, I want to bring the conversation finally back to Britain, because the question of a ban has been raised.
Yes.
Yasmin Alibi Brown says she doesn't support a ban because that's a very crude weapon, but she does think there should be dress codes, for example, in school classrooms or in university lecture rooms, that people should have to show their face. Would you be willing to accept that?
Yes, I already don't wear my hijab in the school classroom. I'll be teaching children in a school and I take my hijab down. If there's not a female doctor available, I can take it down. Every single place I need to go to a bank, at places at the airport, when they ask me to show they want to check my identity, I ask for a female and there's never ever been a problem.
Shahida Salim and Yasmin Alibi Brown. That's it from Politics UK this week. Our editors were Elaine Thomas and Paul Twin. MPs begin their long break on Tuesday, so next week's programme will be the last in our current run. From me, Edward Sturton, have a wonderful summer.